Daniel Larry Scrivenage, is that correct?
Close, it's Scrivenage.
Scrivenage, I'm sorry, Scrivenage versus Lisa Cooper Scrivenage, record number 1367-23-1. We have Hope Hutcherson for the appellant and Archer L. Jones II for the appellee, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and Ms. Hutcherson, if you want to come forward.
Yes.
You have 15 minutes to argue. How much of that time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
Okay, we'll put you down for 3 minutes.
Thank you.
And if you could, okay. And you can begin whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Hope Hutchinson. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Daniel Scrivenage. He's the appellant and husband in the lower court's divorce proceedings. The trial court erred in finding there was no material change in circumstances without hearing any evidence or testimony of the parties and just relying on the brief.
Judge Athey, let me ask you a question. Just in both your first and second assignments of error,
yes,
you assign error to the trial court for reaching its decision off of proffered facts.
That's
of both
correct.
Parties' best case scenario. And in reading them, it seemed to me that is it your contention that the circuit court erred solely by making its determination on proffered evidence, or was there another issue that you had with the proffer itself, or is it just limited to, is it just your position that you can't make that determination off of proffered evidence at all, or is there a particular problem with the proffered evidence itself?
No, you are correct. The issue is that the decision was made with only proffered evidence and not hearing actual evidence of the parties and testimony. I think when you look at Keel versus Keel, the Supreme Court specifically stated that the court should consider the broadest range of evidence, but we weren't even given that opportunity to give the court the evidence.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
So I can make sure I understand the record. I do understand that the court, as an initial matter, did ask the court to proffer their evidence, and the court was going to try to make a determination based on that, and then counsel objected to the court's ruling on that. It's my understanding, I thought that the court did hear evidence at that point or consider the evidence at that point. Is that true or not?
That is incorrect. The court did not hear any evidence. It was only the brief proffer of counsel. On behalf of my client, I proffered the test, what would be the evidence, but there was not an opportunity for my client to be heard. He never took the witness stand. We weren't able to call witnesses. There was
But isn't it accurate that proffered evidence, a proper proffer, I think it's out of the Bethea versus Commonwealth case, 297 Virginia 730, basically says a proper proffer, if unchallenged, is competent evidence before the court. So it is evidence before the court, is it not? And it was not challenged at the time that it was actually given. Isn't that correct?
I agree it wasn't challenged, but I don't believe it was a proper proffer. For it to be a proper proffer, we would have been able to get into more detail. It was only a summation of what the evidence was. The court, before we even started the proffer, specifically stated to the counsel and the parties, and this was in the record, stated, before I make a ruling, I want to hear a brief proffer of the evidence. I mean, before I hear the evidence, I want to hear a brief proffer. So the court gave notice it was going to hear evidence, but after hearing the brief proffer, changed its mind when counsel was unable to go back and redo the proffer. And that was the issue for this court.
Excuse me, did the witnesses, and I don't believe they did, but correct me if I'm wrong, did they take the stand and take the oath and say that would be my testimony as offered by counsel?
No, Your Honor. That didn't happen at all.
So how is it truly a proffer then? Right?
Exactly. I agree with you. That's what the issue is. It's not truly a proffer. But I mean,
even let's assume that the evidence would have come in, how would the arguments of the four different alleged change in circumstance rise to a change in material change in circumstance?
Well, I think
if you look at the facts, it didn't seem to me that all that much had changed.
Well, Your Honor, at the time, my client was going to testify that he had changed his employment. And I think that's a significant change. When the parties first entered into the agreement, my client was basically a maritime seaman. He was on a boat 6 months out of the year. At the time of the court that day, he decided he would become an HVAC repairman, so he was no longer traveling. We also have the fact that the mother made a unilateral decision to get the child a COVID vaccination over the objection. I believe that was relative to the material change of circumstances regarding legal custody. The children were in different schools, and the parties weren't even operating under the current construct of the order that was in place from the JDR court. Those in itself are significant material change of circumstances, and Keel versus Keel says that we look at not only negative but positive changes in both the parents and the children. So the change in employment, especially when it would amend when my client would be available for the children, is a significant change. Their schooling, when the change of schools and where they were going to school, is also a significant change. And we are supposed to consider the broadest range of evidence. But if you don't even have the opportunity for evidence to be heard, and it wasn't a proper proffer, as Your Honor pointed out, then...
Well, let's say that I agree with you.
Okay.
Let's say that. Why wouldn't our case, I think it's Moore versus Joe, actually I think it was authored by Judge Ortiz, it's in 2023, Moore, the court found that proffered evidence that had been excluded over the appellant's objections would not have affected the outcome of the case because the circuit court had accepted all of the appellant's proffers regarding the contents of the excluded evidence and considers those proffers in its decision. And basically in that one it did the same thing. It said, what's your best case scenario? And as a result of that, in that particular case, we actually found that yes, it was error because it was not a proper proffer, but we found that it was harmless error because basically the proffer itself would have not affected in any way the outcome of the case. Why wouldn't, consistent with that case, we wouldn't find the same thing here if we agreed with you that the proffer was not proper?
So if I understand correctly, Your Honor, please correct me if I'm wrong. You're asking why the proffered, if it were a proper proffer, would not have affected the case. Well, one of the issues, my client was alleged.
I mean, it's a best case scenario.
Yes.
So your counsel in this case said, here's my best case scenario. Mm-hmm. Maybe he did that improperly. But the judge heard that during an Ori Tennis hearing, made a decision with respect to it. And why wouldn't we in this case, is there, I think going towards what Judge Ortiz is sort of getting at, is what additional facts that he did not hear that would have changed the outcome of the case? I mean, they gave their best case scenario. Let's say it was error for them to do it in that way. Why wouldn't it be harmless because the proffers would not have changed in any way the outcome of the case, would it?
I think it would have changed the outcome of
Was there something that wasn't proffered?
No, I do not believe so.
That was an additional fact that maybe would have changed the outcome with respect to whether there had been a change in circumstance?
I think there was an additional fact that was not proffered with regards to the custody case, but it came out actually in the subsequent spousal support matter. I mean, it was the same day, but in the spousal support is that there was a man, a paramour, that was living with the mother for a substantial period of time, and that was not able to be proffered, and the impact of this man being thoroughly involved in the children's lives and how that impacted the children was not something that was proffered to the court.
But why not? I mean, why is that? The court asked for the best case scenario, and that wasn't offered.
Well,
so why should we look back and say, we could have come up with 1,000 other facts that weren't even proffered after the ruling that would have been put in evidence? Here's what we would have put on the record, Judge, had we gone forward with the evidence. We don't have that type of proffer either.
Yeah, and frankly, Your Honor, we weren't aware of the scenario regarding the relationship existing between the children and the paramour until this evidence was brought before the court regarding the spousal support factors. And we heard testimony from not only the mother, but the grandfather and the boyfriend about the relationship existing between the children and how he helped with certain activities. So while I understand the court ruled on the custody issue, more issues were brought to light later on during the spousal support part of the hearing that we could have brought forward maybe in rebuttal if the court hadn't already made a decision regarding that there was no material change of circumstances.
Right, so digging into it, I looked at it, there was four things that you proffered. The wife unilaterally vaccinated the children.
Yes.
And the order seems to give either parent the ability to make healthcare decisions. So I'm not sure how that's a material change. Two, wife continued to threaten his life. Court pointed out the two had not gotten along for years. That wasn't a material change. Three, the wife was hospitalized for bipolar disorder in September 2020. This hearing is in 2023, so I'm not sure how that is relevant and could be a material change. And then four, he had recently quit his job. That's probably what I suspect is your best argument. In effect, he would still have his same time. He just wouldn't lose the extra time that she got when he went away to sea. So I'm not sure how that's a material change.
If I may comment on the
sure.
hospitalization and mental health, and as a little warning, I was not the first or second attorney on this matter, so I came involved later. But in 2019, June of 2019, when they made the determination regarding the custody order, there was a provision removed regarding oversight with regard to the mother's mental health. So the 2020 hospitalization was a material change because of that lack of oversight. And my client didn't have knowledge of the hospitalization, from what I gleaned, until I was retained to represent him in late 2022, early 2023.
She'd been in and out of the hospital for years, right?
Yes.
Pre 2019.
Right, exactly.
So a new hospitalization isn't a new material change in circumstances.
It is new in a sense that it was after the court had removed the oversight of her mother's mental health.
Ms. Hutchison, you're about to get in your rebuttal time.
Yes.
Do you want to reserve the rest of it for rebuttal?
I do.
Okay,
I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Archer Jones. I'm here representing Lisa Cooper Scrivenich. She and her father are here today. Your Honors, you've certainly already picked up on a big part of my view of the case. The court, on its own motion, responding to the fact both parties had filed a motion seeking amendment to the change in custody, directed us to provide proffers of evidence that would justify, from our point of view, a material change in circumstance from the then existing and continuing to exist order. Counsel for both parties did so. And after that, the court analyzed, and as you pointed out, the court said, give me your best evidence, a proffer of your best evidence on the issue, as well as your best argument. And at the conclusion of our proffers, he says, all right, to both of you, is that all you got? Is that the best you have? And we both said yes. Then the court gave a very nuanced observation of the evidence proffered in light of the guardian ad litem's report. And by the way, just to make sure the record is correct, it is my understanding the guardian supports the appellee's position in this argument. But the court found, after a very nuanced evaluation of those three things, that there was no material change in circumstance, and he denied the motions of both parties. significantly, there was no objection to the court suggesting that it be, or requiring that it be done by proffer. There was no objection of any nature to the court's conduct until after the court had made its ruling, told the guardian ad litem to leave, we're not going to need your services anymore, took a recess, was about ready to pick up the second issue, and that's when, for the first time, appellant's counsel said, we are objecting to your ruling based upon the fact that you have not seen evidence presented. That's all she said. The court said thank you. She said thank you. We immediately took up the next issue. 5 months later, when counsel for the appellate presented the final decree of divorce, she presented it with her memorandum of objections. There were 7 different objections, 4 of which concerned this issue. The first 2 merely rehashed the fact that she was unhappy the court did not base its decision on testimony given before the court. The other 2 were really an argument on the sufficiency of the evidence, claiming that the judge should not have ruled as he did because she claimed that their evidence proved a material change in circumstance. The point here, I believe, Your Honor, is there was no objection to the court saying, give me proffered evidence. There was no objection to the manner in which the court received the proffered evidence.
Let me ask you this question, and we understand your argument that counsel either acquiesced or agreed to have the court consider the evidence by proffer, or once the court, or if they didn't, they didn't object to it. So that's essentially your argument.
Correct.
Appellant makes an argument that makes one argument that part of their evidence wasn't included in that proffer, and that's the evidence dealing with, as they describe, the paramour being with the children. What is your response to that argument?
Several, Your Honor. Number one, had the evidence been presented by testimony, that evidence would have been over before we took up the next issue, the issue of the paramour and all of that. So I don't believe that the appellant would have become aware of that fact under that set of circumstances. And the court asks for everything you have. And whether you give it by proffer or by testimonial evidence, there's always times when you don't get in certain evidence or you find out things later. I don't think that is a relevant consideration under these circumstances.
Going to the second issue that's addressed in the case, which is the spousal support, it looks like, you know, the Pellegrin case basically, you know, makes the determination based on a common residence, the intimate or romantic involvement, provisions of financial support, and the duration and continuity of the relationship and other indicia of permanency. Here in this record, the husband appears to have proffered evidence that showed a romantic relationship between Hudson and the wife, and that this relationship had some level of permanency to the point it existed at the time he brought the suit. What I'm interested is whether there was there any evidence that supported husband's contention that Hudson and the wife cohabited or that he financially supported her. Now, the court made a determination, it seems to me, that they did not cohabit. But there was some establishment that, you know, he stayed a couple of nights a week at the house. Now, is there a per se rule with respect to cohabitation? Was it error for the court? Would it had to have been proven that they stayed every night there or lived there? Or is there a point at which when you stay over, you know, multiple nights during a week, that that's enough to meet that first prong?
Your Honor, there's no bright line. There's no whether it's one night, two night, three night, four night, five night. the court has got to evaluate under all the circumstances whether it's a relationship analogous to marriage. Do the parties support one another as married people do? Judge Farmer found there was no common residence. There was no cohabitation. He looked very carefully at all the evidence that was presented. Primarily, he started with the private detective. And as you'll recall in the evidence, he said over the entire period of time he surveilled, my client and her friend were together 4% of the time. Under a more compact view, he said the best you can say is they were together 10% of the time. He said, based upon the testimony of my client, her friend, and her father, they may have been together between 2 and 3 nights a week. Mm-hmm. And he said, under his understanding of the facts of the case, and he made specific reference to...
Does that make, let me further on that.
Yes, sir.
Does that make it fatal? In other words, does Pellegrin stand for the proposition that you first, as a threshold matter, must establish the cohabitation?
Yes, sir.
And then after that, whether or not the cohabitation is akin to marriage, you take into consideration the other factors, or is it just one of the other factors? Because, I mean, in this case, there was some establishment of the factors 2 and 3, and factors 1 and 4 was the problem. Is there a balancing that goes on there, or do you first have to establish under Pellegrin that there is cohabitation, and then only after you establish that do you then go to the other factors?
I believe that is correct under Pellegrin. And appellate's counsel acknowledged in her argument to the court that you have to establish cohabitation or sharing a common residence. After you do that, then you look at the other 3 elements. And on this case, the court found clearly there was acknowledgement of intimacy. Check that off, and he as much as said so. He said there is no evidence of where Alex shared finances with my client.
Right, let me ask you one additional question. This goes back to the other issue we talked about.
Yes, sir.
The proffer and this discussion about proper proffer or improper proffer.
Right.
The objection to the proffer, would it have been necessary that when the judge proposed the proffer, saying, give me your best case scenario, that your opposing counsel would have had to objected right then and said, judge, we don't want to do this on proffer. We want to put evidence on one. Or was it satisfactory that they went through the process, best case scenario, and then later objected to it? Did they waive anything by waiting to object to it until later?
Your Honor, I think they waived. I think when the judge says, give me proffers, I think you have a responsibility at that point under the evidence. The decision was to permit evidence to be received in an unusual way. The court has the authority to do that unless someone challenges it as a violation of a statute.
Would you agree here that if there had been a challenge, then we'd be in a, if there had been a challenge at the point in time that the judge proposed the scenario, that it would have clearly been error, because if either counsel would have said, no, I don't want to do a proffer, I want to put on the evidence, that the trial court has to let them put on the evidence as opposed to taking the evidence by proffer?
My case would have been a lot weaker if that had occurred, Your Honor. I was surprised the judge did it.
Well, and to that point, if I can interrupt.
Excuse me.
And I apologize, Judge Athey.
Sure.
But to that point, as you said, you were surprised that the court did it that way. Wouldn't it be reasonable and fair to think that appellate counsel wasn't certain whether the court was going to just take the proffer as the only evidence the court was going to consider for the change in circumstances modification consideration?
certainly that she may have had to wait until she found out that that was it, but she's got to make the objection promptly and at a time under the statute and the rule that the court has an opportunity to deal with it.
Well, the court did have an opportunity to deal with it because the court did, the parties were there not only for the change in circumstance modification for the spousal support, but also for the for the custody, but also for the spousal support as well, too. And so the court could have taken it up afterwards, isn't that correct?
It would have been difficult because, if you will recall in the record, the court said there's no material change in circumstance. Madam Guardian ad litem, you can leave. And she was gone. Under our system, yeah, the court could have said, I made a mistake, and we're going to continue this to another day to take that issue up. That's unlikely, impractical, and it's speculative because the objection was never made until after the guardian ad litem had left.
I mean, to some extent, we don't want trial judges going over here and trying every case, taking proffer evidence. Let me ask you a question about this. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that we do find that it was error in this particular case to utilize this particular best case scenario. Wouldn't it still be under this Moore versus Joe case harmless error? It seems to me that we've decided something like this once before in Moore versus Joe, where the husband agreed that his proffered evidence represented his best case scenario if all of the evidence went his way. That's an actual quote out of Moore. But we decided in that particular case that it was error to accept. Now, the facts are somewhat different in Moore, I'll grant you that. But we decided at the end of the day that there was nothing that would have changed the outcome anyway, and so we called it we basically said the error is harmless, even though it was error. I mean, that's one concern that obviously we want judges to take evidence, and a proffer is evidence if it's unobjected to and everybody agrees, and we have cases that say that too, but I don't know if that's what we want to be encouraging trial judges to do or not. Is it harmless error, I guess is the question, even if it's error?
Yes, Your Honor, I intended to argue that today because I think Judge Farmer was very aware of the facts on both issues. I think to read his assessment of the proffers in light of the guardian ad litem report and the terms of the order, he got it right. And I believe it's harmless error. If it's error at all.
Do you also think that the nature of it, and this will be my last question, the nature of these kinds of cases where a decision has already been made in the domestic relations case, where there has to be a change in material circumstance, this type of decision-making by proffer may be more appropriate in those types of cases than what we would find or in a criminal, obviously, sentencing context than we would find in your standard civil cases?
Certainly, I can agree with that. The court was familiar with these parties for some time.
Right.
And I frankly think that's why I did it. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. I wanted to address whether or not an objection was made timely on the record. If we look at specifically the cases cited to by counsel in wife's brief, like Lee versus Lee, that was a case where the appellant simply put, seen and objected to. The objection was made at the time of the final order, and because the appellate in that case only objected to the entry of the order, the court just said they didn't have enough time to correct the error. Where in my case, I actually made the objection after we took a brief recess, but before we took up evidence on another issue, and so the court had time to correct that error. We also look at, let me slow down. Is where we look at Reed versus Baumgartner. The Supreme Court said objection could come in later in the proceedings and even afforded the court the opportunity for reconsideration. So it's not that you have to make it immediately when the objectionable action is done, but it has to be done in some time frame within that proceeding where the court can remediate any issue. And so in Reed versus Baumgartner, the Supreme Court permitted the later objection and said it was properly preserved. And the final case that is cited to by wife, she...
Isn't the difficulty there is you start, you know, it starts with, we agree to do it this way, and then you get an outcome, of course, that is undesirable for your client, and then you object to it. I mean, isn't that what the record here reflects?
I don't think so, because okay. I didn't agree to do it this way.
You certainly didn't object when the judge said, right. This is what we're going to do.
But the court...
You didn't say, no, judge, I don't want to do it that way. I want to put evidence on. I'm not saying you had to. I'm just right. saying that wouldn't that be different than this scenario, even though you made it the objection was made after the outcome was already determined.
Well, the court in this case didn't say, I'm going to take proffers and not evidence. The court said, so before I take evidence on that issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, once again, back to Judge Ortiz's question. Mm-hmm. What additional evidence would you have put on that was not covered by the proffer or that the trial court did not mention in its final order?
I believe it would be the evidence of the boyfriend, but I also... do believe, Your Honor, if the issues came out and they were more exhaustive with the testimony, the impact that the material change I proffered would have had on the children would have been able to be expounded upon. But given that the fact that it was, the court said a brief proffer, we didn't have the opportunity to do so. My experience with giving a brief proffer,
of course.
Is where you outline a proper proffer, you totally outline the evidence that is coming before the court. Thank you.